Howie, KQER, W2BDQ, well, capacitors always add in parallel, cap. So the more capacitance you have in a power supply, the better. That's the whole purpose of the capacitor, is to smooth out the waveform. So bigger, better, higher voltage, always works.
Agree.
Okay, we had JK and we have someone that says disagree, and I don't think it's JK, so let's go in order. Let's go to JK first, and then we'll pick up the final comment, or maybe not final. JK, go ahead.
Okay, one thing about the Bodak is, really, to you just don't plug them in. They haven't been used in a long time. If you could borrow a Variac, it can start them out at a lower voltage and make the voltage up. You can squeeze in these capacitors, get some life out of them. It works sometimes. Or I've used light bulb, a small light bulb, like I say, a 50 light bulb in series, or back into a 25 or something. That way, but the electrolytic is gone. Try to get one the same value. I know I picked up a radio that was problem with the electrolytic. Fortunately, I had one in my junk box. It was the same size and everything, and it fit right in. So you might be able to get something at a ham fest if you think you got a bad electrolytic, got a hum on your output. Then you probably the electrolytic and the power supply is the first. Back to that W2JK.
Okay, thank you. This is K2EIR. Now, someone said they disagree, and I don't think it was JK. I think it was somebody else. So, that station, go ahead.
Okay, WA2QBC with a slight disagreement here. You can certainly get a cap that has a much higher voltage rating, and that's going to be safe. Caps come in different temperature ratings, and certain applications will require higher temperature caps, like 105C or even higher potentially. You're unlikely to see anything like that in a boat anchor. Now, there was a comment about higher capacitance is always good, and that's where I have a disagreement. The more capacitance you have means the more inrush current you have at startup. Those boat anchors, some of the diodes, if they were solid state diodes or tubes, are not necessarily designed to handle bigger inrush. So if you grossly oversize your cap, you could very well exceed the inrush and blow something else out as a consequence. Let me let it drop. You could parallel cap to add capacitance. You could series cap to get higher voltage, which of course cuts the total capacitance in the string. Both techniques have been used all over the place. The newer caps you'll find are much smaller than the caps in your boat anchors by a wide margin. You may not find the same base mounting. You may have axial leads, you may have radial leads. A lot of the old boat anchor caps were designed with metal tabs that you twist to hold them in place. Mechanically, you may have to do some tricks. There's also a set of people out there that will work on boat anchors, try to keep the device as stock as possible, appearance as stock as possible. So you'll have to consider that when you're trying to repair some of these things. Best to try to keep the capacitance as close as you can. Higher voltages are fine. Higher temperature ratings, if there's even one listed, would be fine.
Very good, Bruce. This is K2EIR. Well, I think there's also factors of resistance across capacitors when you're using multiple capacitors, for example, in a series string. Again, I'm not sure. I do know that many, because the newer capacitors are smaller, and most of the newer capacitors have smaller working voltages. You've got to do something, you know. So what I do know, Walter, is that there's an aftermarket. There are people who, and in some cases, will make a can for you so that you can put it in where the old one was. And inside, internally, there may be multiple caps and properly configured. But that's something you have to find out. And sometimes, as Bruce is pointing coming out, they may not be quite, they may not act the way the originals did. So those are some of the other factors. Let's open it up again, see any, if anybody else wants to comment further for Walter, and then we'll let Walter respond. Anybody else with a comment?
JEK.
At JEK.
Now, one thing, we're talking mostly filter capacitors, but the other capacitors that are radio, especially in the tuning section, you may have silver mica capacitors or plain micas or ceramic capacitors. Have a defective, to replace them with any kind. And you can't say, well, I put a 0.0 microfarad in here, or I just put another 0.01 in. It might not be the same. And some of the ceramics, for example, have what they call negative temperature coefficients, or have any have different tolerances. And shotgun, anything, and just start replacing capacitors, they're bad, and then get the exact same kind. The power supplies are critical in that respect. Back to net, W2JK.
Make absolutely sure when replacing electrolytics you get the polarity right.
Another good point. Okay. And we should also remember that today there are many more types of capacitors that didn't exist, you know, polystyrene and all that. And so I guess it's sort of an art and a science to pick what kind of substitutions you might want if you can't get the exact same type as the original equipment. Anyone have a comment on that?
Yeah, Howie. A lot of times I would change to the tantalum capacitors.
Very good, Rich. Anyone else?
UBC again.
Bruce.
N2VHZ.
Would an electrolytic? There are certainly plenty of electrolytics out there that'll handle the high voltages, but that are typical in a tube-type radio. And by high voltages, I'm talking anywhere from 100 volts up to 300, 400 volts. And in a transmitter-type equipment, you could be 700, 800 volts. And in an amplifier, you could go 3.5 kilovolts and even higher. So there's a whole bunch of factors there.
Okay, Bruce, we have Ken on the side, and because EchoLink has a delay, there was a little bit of doubling there. Could you just repeat the beginning of your transmission, if you recall it?
I was saying the tantalums are generally a lower voltage component. They're good quality, but they won't necessarily handle the voltages present in tube radios, which typically run 100 volts and up 300, 400 volts, typically in receivers. You'll get that high. In transmitters, particularly in the finals, you could be 600-700 volts on the finals. Amplifiers will go to 3 and 4 kilovolts in certain types of amps. Now, when in doubt, the best thing is Barra has a kid night. The information is on the calendar, on the website, and kid night meets at, I believe, 7 p.m. most every Tuesday night, usually in the Westwood High School while school is in session. And there are a lot of folks that will show up there that can give you advice. So bring your boat anchor out to kid night and we can take a look at it and maybe offer some suggestions up.
Very good, Bruce. Thank you very much. We have Ken on the side. Let me just let Walter know so it's very clear. BARA is Bergen Amateur Radio Association. And if you Google that, again, look for kid night, K-I-T. You know, when both Heath kids and Knight kids and all sorts of newer kids, Walter. So that's what Bruce is talking about. You can look it up on, you can Google it, and you can go to one of their meetings. Before I turn to Ken, let me just make sure, Walter, you got that, okay?
Yeah, I got that. Actually, it's kind of a blessing and a curse. I have more boat anchors than I know what to do. A Hamelin SP600, a 105DR, like a 150. I have a Halicrafters SX16, SX17. I have an SX25. I have an SX28. You get the idea. So I'm going to have to pick my favorite ones to bring down a kit tonight. But kind of can't wait. Thank you guys a lot for this. I'm pulling up my notepad here with I don't know any of this about clarity and all that. I got a lot of reading to do, I guess.
I'd recommend going slow. You know, what do they say? Measure twice, cut once. Same thing here. Okay, Ken has been waiting in the wings. N2VHZ, K2EIR. Go ahead, Ken.
Yeah, this is N2VHZ. Thanks for catching me, man. And I wanted to say to Walter that you got to be careful with those caps because they hold a charge. It acts as a small battery. But I had experience in the past where I went and purchased some new old stock electrolytic caps. And they're not, they appear, in appearance, they seem fine, and they were never energized. So I was under the impression that I'm going to get a lifelong, span out of these things of years and years and years. They weren't much better than the ones that I replaced because they were dated almost to the same date that the ones that I replaced with. So when I did remove the defective or worn-out capacitors that were leaking, the electrolytics, and placed the new old stock in there, I got a very short lifespan out of them because they weren't much younger than the ones that I replaced. They have a limited lifespan, and what happens is if you buy new old stock, you're buying something that's not going to last very long because it's already probably 9/10 of the way towards death, you know? So you have to be aware of that. If somebody tries to pawn off NOS on you and saying they're just as good as new, no, they're not. They're from the 1940s and 50s. You might as well just walk away. Or even 60s or 70s. You can forget it, you know? I just wanted to add that comment back to NetControl.
Roger, Ken. Thank you very much. K2EIR. In case we have anyone who's listening who does not know the term NOS or new old stock, let me give my definition. It might have been apparent from what Ken said, but you can purchase inventory, people who have gotten inventory parts that may have been in warehouses, never opened, never used, but they are the original equipment, and they are as old as the original equipment. So you can buy, for example, electrolytic capacitors that may have been manufactured in the 1940s. And again, they are, quote, brand new, but they are just as old, and that's what Ken's talking about. And the term is called new old stock, because it's old, but it's new because it hasn't been purchased before. It's not used. Okay, enough clarification on that. Anybody else on this topic before we try to move on and let, even at this late hour, the people who still have some comments and questions get their turn. Anybody want to say anything more on this topic? K2EIR. Just a call. Go ahead.
Okay. Generally, as these caps get older, the electrolytic caps, they lose their capacitance. They get weaker and weaker, which means you get more ripple on the output of the power supply, which means you start seeing or hearing 60-cycle hum and all sorts of other interesting things happen in your receiver. There are ways of measuring their caps. There are meters that do that, commercial meters. There are also some cheap Chinese ESR meters showing up. I've got one on order I should have in a couple of days. Haven't tried it yet. I have no idea how well they work. Other people say they do. But you can certainly check the value of these caps. Now, the old electrolytics had a habit of drying out. So the electrolyte that's inside, there's some liquid in there, will also leak. So if they leak, consider them bad. The old ones dry out, and when they dry out, they lose their capacitance. That's what happened to a number of caps in an amplifier I just overhauled. And I simply replaced them with a more modern version, and it was fine.
Okay, I think that was Bruce. Thank you very much for that comment. Once again, anybody else on this topic before we go on?
Yeah, this is KCWJ. You know, up there I asked the question to begin with. I'll put it out there too if anybody has any parts for, mostly actually for helicrafters, you know.
Okay, anyone?
I think you'll have to be a lot more specific.
How about S meter for an SX16?
WA2UMP with a comment.
Go ahead, Jim.
Yeah, I have a whole arsenal of boat anchors. I'm slowly selling them off, but not many years ago I was heavily into this. The best place to get these parts, there is a a reflector called boat anchors. There's also other ones for specialty radios like National and a few others, but boat anchors is the best general one. If you're not already a member of that reflector, that's the best place to look. And people advertise parts, and you can put out a request for a specific part or find an old junk chassis for your helicopters. If you're into helicopters, it doesn't hurt to have a couple of junkers aside you can take parts from.
Okay, thank you, Jim. Walter, any response?
Oh, that's it. I got the stuff written down. I just want to thank everybody for their time. It's been great. I've never been part of a one of these. I actually forget the name. But fantastic. Thank you, everybody. KC2 WDJ.
Okay, Walter. Well, you know why I show up here often. You understand. Okay, I do want to move on. Richard, did we cover your comment, or is that separate? W2PDQ. This is K2EIR.
K2EIR. No, Howie, all I have is a little comment about something I found on the internet that might be interested to some contesters, which is this little Adafruit Audio FX soundboard, which push a button and it says your call.
Okay, that sounds interesting. Might you send Gordon or me some sort of reference so that it gets published on the Comtech group? And, oh, I should mention that. Walter and everybody else, especially people, Gordon runs a Yahoo group called Comtech Group. Let me see if Steve is here. Steve, do you know how to spell it so people can find this? I have a better choice than Steve. I know Randy participates. Randy, can you tell us how to find the Comtech group on Yahoo for those who need to? U2S, are you still here? K2EIR? Steve, are you still here? WI2W?
Double.
Yeah, I'm still here, Howie.
Okay, can you spell Comtech Group on Yahoo for everyone so they get it right to check it out or join?
Sure. It's Comtechgroup. So it's com with one M. Comtechgroup, Comtech Group, all one word. And if you search for that, it's a Yahoo group. You can sign up for it. Back to net, K2BARWI2W.
Roger, thank you. The Comtech Group supplements this net, and again, I encourage you, Richard, to send something either there or to Gordon or to me. You can look up my call on QRZ, my email on QRZ.com, and we'll get it more widely distributed. I think that would be less confusing than trying to spell it out right now. Let me move on, unless you have anything further, Richard. Let me just check. Do you have anything further?
No, it's just that I saw this little gizmo. It's like $20, and normally the voice IDs are like 260 and up. And I thought it was just a unique standalone. It's not a breakout board. It's a standalone little gizmo. So I thought it might be interesting to somebody with that does contests and such. Back to you. Thank you, Howard. You're doing a splendid job tonight.
Thank you. Actually, let me try to improve upon my job. Let me have you give the URL again or whatever. I'll try to write it down. Others will too, so that will supplement any email you send in case you forget or get tied up. Tell us where we can find this $20 talking board.
H-U-E-R-W-2-P-D-Q. It's Adafruit. It is ADA Foxtrot Romeo Uniform India Tango.com. And it's Audio FX soundboard.
I got it. Still writing, but I got it. Thank you, Rich. I'm interested. See if I do anything about it. Okay. Thank you very much, Rich. We appreciate that. I just want to go on because it is late. I know Gene had a question. KC2WDC, if you're still with us, Gene, we're welcome. We'd welcome your question, and hopefully we still can get you an answer. Okay. I guess that's the trouble with not being the first to check in. You're later down the list. We'll just make one more try. KC2WDZ from K2EIR. Nothing heard. Okay. Well, I've covered the whole list. I haven't asked for any additional check-ins for a while, so basically we're at the point in the net where I'm ready to close, but if anyone has any further comments, questions, etc., now's the time to speak up. So if you'd like to bring anything up, call me, K2EIR. This is the Bergen Amateur Radio Association and the Chestnut Ridge Radio Club Technical Net. Anyone with any business, call now.
D2JEK with a comment for K2ZO.
Go ahead.
Jim, if you're there, I have a Hewlett Packard printer here, and I went through the instruction book, didn't see anything about startup cartridges, although the printer came with a couple of cartridges. Now, I do know that a Hewlett Packard type number 60, and they have black cartridges, and they have three different kinds. I've gotten the regular black cartridge. They have a 60XL, which has about three times the amount of ink that the standard cartridge has. Then they have another one called the economy cartridge, which has less ink in it. Same size cartridge, but different amounts of ink. Now, I think maybe that economy cartridge might have been maybe they had a surplus of startup cartridges. Curtis peddling the economy cartridges at what time, I don't know. It sounds that it's better to buy the color, so I use the ink. Back to that, W2JK.
Okay, Jim, are you still here? Did you copy that? Okay, the hour grows late. I think, Don, you better send it to him in an email. That's probably the best thing to do. Okay, one more standby, final standby. Any other business for the net? Any comments, questions, whatever, call K2EIR.
And 2VHZ.
Hey, Ken, your turn. Go ahead.
Okay, great. Good evening. And hopefully this is the last thing to say. And we didn't go over one thing, and that's about the safety of the yourself working with electrolytic capacitors and going into a chassis that has potential for high voltage. We didn't cover anything about using the one-hand rule. I don't think many people even know about that anymore. You know, now that people don't stick their hands inside of equipment anymore, more or less. So the one-hand rule, I think we should go over. Maybe you could elaborate on that, net control, with your infinite wisdom in these matters. And then also the safe discharge technique of an electrolytic capacitor. Everybody has a different way of discharging them, and I think it's important and imperative that the gentleman knows that these things can retain voltages that could possibly really bite you. They have bite voltages, you know? So perhaps with net control, you could elaborate a little bit on maybe the way that you would discharge an electrolytic capacitor and approach a high voltage chassis with one hand rule as not to allow the voltage to find its way through your heart, through the other hand, and then defibrillate you and kill you right there in front of the equipment because it's seeking out ground. Back to net.
Roger, Ken. This is K2EIR. Okay, I'll try to do my best on this and try to be succinct, but I would especially recommend that Walter actually go to a BARA meeting and bring this up. But for everyone's sake, the one-hand rule, as I learned it, is that when you're putting a screwdriver or other tool or whatever into the guts of older chassis, you keep the other hand in your pocket or some
place insulated, certainly not on the, you don't take, say, the left hand and hold the chassis, the metal with your flesh, while you put in the right hand with a tool or whatever, because, as Ken pointed out, you will be at ground potential with your left hand, if that's the one you're using, and maybe on high voltage on the right hand, and it doesn't take much current to stop your heart. So you can die, okay? You understand this. You can die. You can be killed inadvertently while working on older equipment with high voltages. And as far as discharging a capacitor, and you should practice this regularly, the way I used to do it was with probes or clips, whatever, that had a high resistance, like 1 megaohm in it, on the capacitor, and then I might, I'd leave that for a while, and then use either a lower resistance or a short, and certainly I would wind up at the end with a short circuit from the capacitor, high voltage terminal to ground. Again, you want to do that when you think it's already fully discharged. This is to get all the voltage out of it. And again, you have to be very careful how you handle all this, because there may be a high voltage and you don't want to be in that path of the high voltage such that current flows through you. That's what you want to avoid. No current through you. Ken, let me turn it back to you and see how I did on this little quiz. And then I'll open it up to the net, and then we'll close the net if we're all done. Back to you, Ken, and to the HZ from K2EIR.
K2EIR, net control, this is N2VHC. Beautiful. I really appreciate it. I couldn't have said it better myself. Actually, you made me think about some things, especially the 1 megaohm resistance, and very, very enlightening, and it's very imperative that this young man does not lean on the chassis. Just like you said, that's a common problem, and then stick your hand in, and you don't realize it, but zip, you're on the floor. Now, the best thing is to put your hand in your pocket. I've learned it the same way, and I want to thank you for elaborating on that in such an eloquent manner, and I'm going to hand it back to you and say thank you very much from Alliance, Nebraska. Back to Net Control.
Yeah, 4GHM,
I'm telling you. Hey, let me give you just a few more thoughts. First of all, make sure you've unplugged the radio from the AC power main. Let it sit for a little while. You can Google chicken stick on the internet. Megaohm is going to take a very long time to discharge some of those caps. You might want to consider is something lower, a couple of K, 5, 10K, and a 2-watt resistor. You hook the ground side of the chicken stick up to the chassis first, and then go in with the probe side and discharge the caps that way. The other thing with the one-hand rule, no jewelry. Remove all rings, watches, metal bands, or anything that's even close, because you don't want to accidentally get that in contact with some hot leads, too.
Okay, very good, Bruce. There were two other stations that I heard in there, so I don't know how to pick you apart. Someone try going, K2EIR.
Kim, 4GHN, comment.
Go ahead, Mitch.
AC, second comment. I used to work with high, big, caps back in the 80s, early 70s, and I used to put big Rubbermaid gloves on, and of course, one-hand rule was great. I was a big fan of simply not being in a hurry if I had time and just let the thing sit unplugged for 2 weeks and then, do the following procedures. But probably the biggest rule is don't be in a hurry. Don't rush.
Good point. And we'll also say with older equipment sometimes there's no isolation. Not only should you unplug it, but if you have to be operating on it with energy, AC energy, keep in mind that there may not be a transformer. Getting an isolation transformer in there, as a general rule, may give you some protection. So no
tip I guess people with experience have. And again, there are various opinions. The safest thing, of course, is when there's no power. And a wonderful reason for going solid state with the lower voltage stuff we have today. Okay, anybody else? There was one more station with a comment. K2EIR? Being heard. Okay. Well, once again, what a fine group of people we had here. I think it was an interesting net. I'm sure some people, those who contributed and helped others, you did your good deed, and it's always wonderful to listen to this thing. Thank you for being here. Please come again. And I want to say 73 and good night. Thank you to the Chestnut Ridge Radio Club and the Bergen Amateur Radio Association for hosting this net. 73 guys, K2EIR will be closing station after a short standby.
Good job, Howie, AC2T.
Outstanding, WI2W. Paul, Roger, Steve, anyone else?
KC2WZJ, just want to say thank you. Most of my radios have been off for more than 50 years, but I will heed your warning. Thank you.
Okay. Three guys, K2EIR.
N2VHC, CAM4GHN.
CAM4GHN, this is N2VHC. Hey, what's up, Mitch? I'm sitting at home for once. What's going on?
Well, that's unusual not to hear you in the yard. I was just going to comment on you're going to be flexibility caps. I spent about a 5-year span also restoring audio gear, pro audio gear like Universal Audio, Yuri, processors, compressors, what have you. And those things were notorious for the caps just drying out or else bulging and blowing up with improper heat sinking. Yeah, I've dealt with that a lot, but a lot of interesting performance, operations when have those things fail or leak or short out.
Yeah, man, especially, I was thinking when you came in with a comment, I was thinking, man, I can only imagine the radio stations what they were running, you know, and their amplifiers. That is completely crazy, you know, and you can just feel the RF when you walk in those rooms properly, you know, the broadcast stations, and that brings danger to a whole new level. And I wanted to also say I think it was pretty funny last night how I linked those repeaters together. But hey, it's all about worldwide communications, right? At one time I had Germany, England, North Carolina, Denver, Colorado, LA, and the one we're talking on all linked together, but nobody was talking. So I took them all down and just left the North Carolina one on there for you. I figured you'd like that one. Back to you.
Well, also one good rule is never mess with a cap bigger than a beer can. But, yeah, I, a lot of that stuff, but, like, I'm not an RF anymore, but when I got into the smaller stuff, the audio, the subtle stuff, audio processing gear and stuff, that was a whole different world from RF days, but, yeah, I don't like the high voltage stuff. I never really did.
Yeah, some of these people that like to have this strange music that gives just like intermittent bass, thumps in their cars, they fill the trunks with these large 1 microfarad capacitors, and they act as storage batteries actually to hold the voltage to give that amplifier that one little kick for that bass, you know, once in a while. And when I saw those, I said, I can't believe you can buy electrolytic capacitors that size, you know. But they buy them for the audio kick, you know. You know what I'm talking about? The people, they put them in their trunks, and they're like the size of a beer can, like you said. Back to you.
Roger, the guys that are next to you in a stoplight and make your trunk rattle, let alone theirs. Yeah, I got that. I don't like the high volume anymore. My age, I probably did a little bit of damage in my early youth on that part. But anyway, it's good fun stuff. And I do kind of miss the old broadcast days of the old AM/FM. But I kind of like being, you know, doing what I'm doing now, more in the creative end of it.
Yeah, I like that whole thing you said about with the Playtex or the Rubbermaid rubber gloves. That was a good idea because they're a little thicker, you know, and you have some grip with them. They're not like these junky neoprene or whatever they are that you put on nowadays, you know. You don't know what's going to happen. And it's good to have, and you know, all of a sudden you see a rip in it, you know, and that'll be the one where you touch ground and then it'll go through that. It'll go through these thin rubber gloves, you know, whereas the ones you're talking about are much better. Before that was interesting. And then what was I going to say to you about? Oh, I have a pair of speakers you might appreciate. They're called Klipsch La Scala. They don't make them anymore unless you pay for it, and then they'll make you a pair. But I bought them. Wait till you hear this. I bought them in 1983 because the guy, I guess the creator, Klipsch, he was an Air Force audiologist or whatever, and he had a special content. He had started his own company, Klipsch, of course, and he always had this good feeling for the military. So what he did is he had special deals where he sold his equipment to the military, to the PX. And I bought them when I was in the Army in 1983, a pair of La Scalas. And I think I paid $500 per speaker, $1,000 a pair. Back then, that was a lot of money. But I still have them. They're in my family room. And I took them apart for the first time in 25, 30 years, whatever. And they look as good on the inside as they look when they're made. They're a folded horn design, you know. And then on the top, with the crossover, everything is pristine condition. They must have used components that were way ahead of their time because nothing is disturbed on that circuit board of that crossover of those La Scalas. And it's, you know, just sitting in the back of the speaker because it uses a horn for a mid-range and a tweeter, and it just sits in the back of those in like a little compartment, so it's in the open air. And man, those speakers have been back and forth across the Atlantic about 5 times, and that's quality. That's audiophile quality right there. Back to you.
Hey, VHC, Cam 4GHN. Yeah, absolutely. Klipsch, actually, I'm quite familiar, obviously, with the pro audio gear and prosumer stuff. Klipsch was probably the very top of the line with and crossed kind of into the prosumer range. If you're not familiar with that term, that's obviously hybrid of consumer and professional. But the Bang & Olufsen probably was a runner-up to that. But, and maybe Harman Kardon, actually. But those are about the three. Klipsch, well, they were predominantly speakers, if not all speakers, as I recall. They rivaled, back in the day, in half live, a JBL was one of the bigger ones. But they definitely rivaled the pro gear, for sure.
This is N2VHC. I'm portable right now, actually, sitting down in my shack talking up to the repeater here in Alliance, Nebraska. It's funny, because when you're saying that, I used to go into CBGB's in New York before. Of course, it's closed down now. And you know what I'm talking about, down in the Bowery. And they used to have Klipsch La Scala hanging all over the place on chains, you know, like these cabinets, because they're this plywood. Let's put it this way. It's a high-quality plywood. Mine are black. Mine are the Discotech versions. And that's the only kind he sold to the PXs, you know. When you walked in, there was a wall of Klipsch speakers, and everything was black. So you didn't have a choice. It was like Model T car or whatever. But I found out later on, for the consumers and the general market and the commercial market, they had different finishes, different veneers. But I didn't have that choice. So I got them in black. They're still in black. And I would walk into CBGB's or another club like that in New York, and they'd hang La Scalas from the ceiling. And you know the good thing about La Scalas? You could play raw music through them. They're so tough that you could
instruments. You can jack them into the speaker, and it won't rip the cone or anything. It won't blow the woof. It's weird. Another strange thing about it, they have very, very high efficiency. I think it's 108 dB at 1 watt, at 1 meter, you know? And you can... Nobody can defeat that. So you can put a low-power monoblock amplifier on each one, maybe a 21 amp, and man, does that bring the room alive, brother. You know what I'm saying? You don't need high power with clips because it's just the efficiency of the speaker is overwhelming back to you.
Yeah, Roger, Ken. If I'm... Now, my recollection fails me when I act this far, but... If I'm not mistaken, I believe some of those, I believe the Klipsch was one of the first to use hybrid or not totally paper cones, thicker paper cones with some kind of fiber. I forgot that so long, but yeah, I do know that those were previous to basically blowing the paper out at high volume in dB. Yes, they were exceptionally efficient. Crossovers were also very impressive for here. I think you alluded to definitely some of those components. Really built like German military standards.
Yeah, it's funny because, you know, they're as big as a wash machine and a dryer. They're the same size as a wash machine or a dryer. So, you know, and they weigh 100 pounds each. So the funny thing is these things being dragged back and forth, you think they'd get damaged. They're pretty much the same shape they were when I bought them in 1983. But the funniest thing was I went online and I found somebody that has actually the I don't know how you would say it, the plans to woodwork and build a half-scale model, an actual half-scale model of these folded horn design speaker. And it's really funny when you look at them at half-scale because they look good, man, you know, and he has a list, a parts list of where to buy the horns for the tweeter and the mid-range, and then where to buy the half-size woofer. And he sells the modern crossovers, more modern components. But it's hilarious when you see them at half-scale. And I said, actually, that's very sensible because these things are so ridiculously large and bulky. Nobody really wants them in their house, you know. Plus, they don't make them anymore, I think, for that reason altogether. You know, they're just too big and stupid. But, you know, like you were saying, these were on the cusp of becoming commercial equipment in some places that didn't have a lot of money that were running on a raggedy budget. They did buy these because these were on the edge of becoming commercial quality. But like you said, they really weren't. They were the high-end consumer, and they didn't ever go into commercial with this. But they had other ones that were pretty decent, you know. Back to you.
Yeah, Ken, I have a keen memory of actually seeing those back speakers. You're talking about CBGB's. Keenest memory I have in that place is how disgusting the bathroom was. Other than that, I've only been there about half a dozen times. Another place I've really liked, I don't know or anything, but a place in Hoboken, New Jersey, Maxwell's. A lot of interesting talent. Shut down, I think, about 3 or 4 years.
Okay, I think I've been to that place in Hoboken, and that's interesting. CBGB's, that's the place where I urinated in the bath when I had to urinate. You stand in the doorway and go on the floor because you can't get to the urinal because there's already an inch of urine covering the entire floor. And then the dressing rooms are back there and it's just a curtain covering them for the talent before they can come out. They have to sit in a little cubicle with a curtain covering it. And the bouncers all have handcuffs tucked in their belts so they can handcuff you. But half the adventure was getting to that place. That's funny that you were there also. So where is Maxwell's in Hoboken? Maybe you can jog my memory. And I remember quite a few places that I don't know if it's still as nice as it used to be, but that was an excellent place to go to on, you know, Friday, Saturday nights. You could eat good. You could go out and have fun. There was always a lot of students there from the university. And is it still the way it used to be, or has it changed dramatically in the last, let's say, 10 years? What's your
you my brief comment and then maybe see if anybody else is out there and wants to chime. Yeah, I moved there. I bought a place there in 10th and Hudson there. I believe it's 12th or 11th and Hudson, Washington. I'm sorry, 11th and Washington. Just an interesting, quirky place. It was pretty well known in the music game for having some, you know, interesting, fresh bands come in and play. And I like the other things we played, but, Hoboken, I left in, say, 2006. I moved up to Edgewater, New Jersey. It was just getting too crowded for me. A lot of, you know, younger folks and kids, and I had no parking spot other than on street. I moved to Edgewater and then finally migrated up here to Dobbs Ferry, where it's very suburban, and I'm kind of one of those guys at heart.
Okay, Mitch. Perfectly understood. It does sound like somebody's keying up when you were talking, but I think they're just trying to be an irritant to our conversation. Hey, I'm looking. I also, you're going to love this one. I bought a set of Heresies, Eclipse Heresies, at a garage sale here when I first moved to Alliance. When things make their way out to Alliance, Nebraska, it's like the black hole. They don't leave. So I found this beautiful pair of Heresies, and I gave the guy $150 for them. Beautiful, pristine condition, right? Beautiful. On eBay, they go for $900, anywhere from $500 to $900 to $1,000 a pair. And these are in beautiful shape, these Heresies from Eclipse. So I use those two, the little Heresies I use as the back of my surround sound system. I have a 7.1 system, and they're like speakers number 6 and 7, you know? So I use them in the background because of the efficiency. Once again, they bring themselves up to the front. It's really funny because they should be in the background, but they bring themselves up to the front because of the efficiency, even of the Heresies. They're the smaller bookshelf type with a smaller, like, 12-inch woofer, but still with the horn mid-range, the horn tweeter, you know? Still with the horn. As Mr. Clipshit said, the horn represents the human throat, so it's better to throw the sound out through a horn. Back to you.
Actually, I'm well aware of that statement. I actually, honestly, am now kind of a new school. As much as I revere old vintage gear, old negative connotation. I'm more with the, you know, probably 10-inch woofers, 12-inch, or even 8-inch with subwoofer powered monitors now. They're just such an easier way to go and sound better. And also, I prefer, you know, the size monitors anyway, bookshelf-ish or larger. Silk dome or ideally actually ribbon tweeters. The metallic type ones, kind of harsh and brittle. Technology's really has quite a bit in the last 15 years.
Yeah, I agree with you. And ribbon is outstanding, but I think, I don't know why more people don't use that. And let me ask you a question. You're the perfect person. I meant to ask you this question before and it's kept slipping my mind. With the albums, you know, the older ones. I'm not talking about, I don't know what they print nowadays, but the older ones, like I have a collection, you probably have one also still, and they had printed into the album, they put some type of a effect on the album called an RIAA equivalency. When I play albums, right, and of course the bandwidth seems like it's not as wide as a CD, but I noticed something immediately when I bought some audiophile equipment. I bought equipment from the post exchange to go with these Eclipse speakers, like let's say an Onkyo amplifier or whatever, the bandwidth of that far surpassed what, you know, from 20 to 20 hertz. Thing went down to, like, say 5 hertz, the amplifier, which most people don't realize. This is the way that you get extended range out of your sounds. And you could go up to 50,000 hertz, right? So what you're doing is you have a wide bandwidth of an amplifier. And when I put an album on, it was, you heard things that you never heard on a normal home stereo, you know? But, and my friend was telling me that's because of the RIAA equivalency stamp onto the album. They actually extend the bandwidth of the sound sometimes to give you more pleasurable, you know, experience listening to an album. Then comes CDs in like 1983, 84, 85.
I bought the Techniques SLP-1, first CD player they made. You know, they had a handful of CDs out, you throw one in, and you could immediately see it was more compressed. And as time goes along, we talk MP3, even more compressed in bandwidth. So my opinion is that the things that are being made now are more for quantity, not quality. And what it is the music to me sounds more harsh no matter what, compared to how it used to sound when it was all widened out with that equipment. You know what I'm saying? Back to you.
Station KM4GHN Friday. A brilliant audio man named George Massenberger made an interesting comment when he went to the CD. Well, he was actually against the CD format or sampling bitrate and everything. MP3s became popular. He said, wow, this is the first so-called, quote, advancement in audio where the quality actually has been degraded versus improved. You're absolutely right with the, very simple, I could go on forever about the old Neumann, record lathes that cut the actual masters. They used to have to compress, I don't mean data compression, I mean audio compression, needles from skipping out of the grooves if they modulated too highly. But that was a real art form, mastering. Mastering was a true art form. Now it's just to make things loud digitally. Whole different ballgame.
This is N2BHZ Portable in Alliance, Nebraska with KM4GHN. Thank you, so. Hey, so Mitch, this is funny. I was in North Carolina and my household goods got delivered to our home and we unpacked them and had them set up. And my neighbor had two sons that were very inquisitive. They were, I'd say, 12 and 15, 14, whatever. They came over and looked at all this weird stuff that I had and, and I said, you look at this. He didn't know what a record player was, what a turntable was, He's never seen an album in his life, and I was surprised. And along come my children now, 1 and 2 years old, right? And I'm going to make sure I hold on to this equipment because now I'm going to hand down a legacy of the mentality of what we just spoke about, because apparently that has evaporated in modern-day technology, and I think it needs to be... The technology that is sitting in the family room over here, for example, is going to become legendary one day, And I want to hand that down to my daughters and show them what this stuff is, because I don't want them to say, what's that thing spinning around, I want them to know what a turntable is, and know how records are pressed. And I heard they're pressing records again. I was overseas when they started doing it, I think. But I heard it's starting to go full blast again. Some people are going crazy with it. And they're coming out with a limited amount of albums and certain types of formats. Are you familiar with that? Back to you.
Yeah, actually, that's never totally gone away. It's waxed and waned over the years. But I tell you, if you sat a person who has ears younger than years old, ear above 8 kilohertz, you A-B the same Bruce Springsteen song or whatever, something that was recorded analog originally, and, you play them a well-pressed vinyl, Harman Kardon tube amp, flipped, speakers, some equivalent, you that full fat bandwidth, I think you alluded to, feel it down at 20 cycles, hertz, and, of course, tubes distorted significantly, but added the warmth that files. Love to talk about. They go to digital, and it just Massenberg was right, in my opinion. Until you get up into sampling rates of 96 or above, with rates of 25, got a good ear. You can hear the difference.
Oh, yeah, and, it's funny, because with these clips, it vibrates your hair follicles, because it goes with certain music. Like, for example, there's a group that I, in particular, too, that it's going to sound kind of stupid, but a lot of people don't know about it. But in your particular area right there where you live, the group is very popular. It's called Return to Forever. It has four, superstars that came together in a studio and formed a band, did a few albums. It's a jazz fusion band with Al DiBiola.
And he plays electric and acoustic guitar, and he's one of the world's greatest guitarists, everybody knows that. And right now he lives in Spain. He's migrated to Spain, has lived there. He's going to live out his life down there and play in some of those tapas bars, like where they serve snacks. He actually plays acoustic guitar down there, from what I heard, you know. And then you have Lenny White on the drums, and then you have Chick Corea on keyboard, and you have, what's his name there? Oh, man, the mainstay of the whole thing on bass. Oh, man, what's his name? Anyway, it doesn't matter. I forgot. I haven't listened to their music in a couple of years now. But Stanley Clark on bass. They play at, you know, jazz festivals all the time and things like this back in the day, and then they broke up, and then they had their own bands. But they came back together briefly, and their statement was, we want to show the world before we can't do it anymore, before we lose the ability, we want to show the world what real music sounds like. And they went on a world tour not too long ago, Return to Forever, which was funny. They went all over Europe also, and it was excellent. They played at the jazz festival in over there in Geneva, Switzerland. And it was Montrose Jazz Festival they played at. And it was excellent. Sold out four nights in a row. No question around it. But I play that music that makes your hair fall. They hit notes and tones and sounds that makes your hair follicles vibrate. And you can't physically, you can't hear it audibly, but you know he's doing something. Stanley Clark, for example, because he'll make your hair follicles vibrate. It's almost like a joke that he's passing through the speaker on to you, back to you.
You know, I was being obviously exaggerative when I said hearing things in 20 cycles. nobody can hear that, human. But, you know, there's been fascinating psychoacoustic tests and other, you know, no tests. There's one of my most fascinating ones I read about was they did a study on people were stone deaf above, I think it was 8 or 10 kilohertz, I can't remember. They did a test where they would put these people, probably older people, I imagine, and they would throw in a filter that would basically completely lob off any frequencies above that, you know, where they're supposedly can't hear. However, you know, so you didn't hear the harmonics. But however, they all noticed the difference because of the lack of the harmonics, upper and lower, probably even lower, in that case. But, and, you know, the psychoacoustics has always fascinated with me, you know, which I had pursued in school. And anyway, long story short, it's, you can, your brain processes probably down to third or fourth harmonics, and, That's part of the whole process, computation there, you know, talking about.
That's pretty interesting, you know, because that could solve a lot of problems for a lot of people if somebody would pursue that direction. I had made a friend of mine in the Army. His name is Colonel Bernhard. He works in Johns Hopkins University. He's an anesthesiologist, but in the military, he was a flight surgeon. He's the guy that flies on a helicopter if you get shot, a medevac helicopter. He's a doctor that accompanies that medevac on board, and he keeps it alive so you get back to the station where they can treat you better. But he was very interested in the digital signal processing part of what happens with audio. And he says, well, his purpose was to be able to use a stethoscope on the battlefield. And he was curious about where he said to me, there's not enough people involved with audio processing or psycho audio processing or anything with that in the medical field, because it's just either they go one way or another, but there's nobody right there doing that. And he says, and he had to figure out how to build a set of digital processing headphones that would knock out, you know, loud explosions, gunshots, but allow him to hear a heartbeat or a pulse. It was pretty interesting when he told me that. And that backs up what you're saying, like, you know, that you wish you had gone into it. I bet